Okay, we'd just like to welcome everyone to Spotlight once more. And Spotlight's the programme where we find out a lot about the background of one of our members. Before I introduce the guest, as always, I'd like to thank Becky for coordination and to Dennis for doing the recording for us. And today we've got someone to talk to who's very interesting, as all our guests are, of course. It's Clifford Wilson from Tennessee. Known as the blind, as the country lawyer, sorry, Cliff, known as the country lawyer. I'd like to begin by welcoming you. And first of all, Clifford, could you tell us a little about your early life? Where and when were you born? And just a little bit about your family.
Okay, Steve, thanks much for the invitation. And I don't know why you got the short end and got the assignment to do this interview, but we'll do our best. I was born in 1943. My dad was in the service of Uncle Sam at the time, and he was drafted, I think, just about the time that, about 3 weeks after my mother and dad were married, and before he was sent overseas, I was put in the oven, so to speak, and I guess I was born just before he left for Great Britain. And he came over and visited your folks over there for a while, and then the third day of the Normandy invasion, they allowed him to cross over and go into France and start his European visit, and he got a tour over there. Meanwhile, I was back in East Tennessee keeping tabs on things, and I turned out to be one of the oldest of five children. My dad did come back after the war, after chasing General Patton around Europe on the Red Ball Express, and we lived in a rural area near a little town called Newport, Tennessee, up until I was 8 years of age. We had no indoor plumbing. We had no electric lights. In fact, we lived very much like the people did 1,000 years earlier, because up until 1946, when I was 3 years of age, we had no vehicles either. So we had to either walk or ride in a wagon, or some even rode the old mules, but we didn't go a lot of places. We did have other relatives who did have vehicles that would allow us to go to town, that sort of thing, but there on the farm, we lived very much like the Egyptians did 2,000 years ago, very rural setting. I was 4 years of age when I was diagnosed as having retinitis pigmentosa, and my folks were advised at that point in time that I would have to attend the Tennessee School for the Blind and would never be able to read or do anything like that, even though I could see some. I could see well enough to, as I tell everyone, I could see good-looking women and automobiles up until I was a teenager or early 20s, and see mountains and large features like that up until my early 30s. So I'm glad I had what vision I did. As long as I did, I now have no light perception or anything like that, but I'm still fortunate to have had what I did, as long as I did. And I still can, I still am assisted by having that knowledge, even though it's a memory. I did attend the Tennessee School for the Blind, and I graduated there in 1962, went on to Tennessee Technological University and got my BS degree in social science, and from there to the University of Tennessee, where I obtained my Doctor of Jurisprudence in 1967. And beginning in 1968, started practicing law in a little town called Madisonville, Tennessee. I live near a little town called Tellico Plains, Tennessee, which is in the same county, but about 17 miles away from the office. But I've been there ever since, and been actively engaged in the practice of law for nearly 35 years now. So that's a thumbnail sketch, I suppose, of my short 60 years.
Okay, Cliff, thanks for the thumbnail sketch. Now, let's fill in a little bit of the detail in more detail, if we can. You're describing an idyllic rural lifestyle when you were a child. It sounds very idyllic, although it probably had its disadvantages being in such a rural location. When you first went to the Tennessee School for the Blind, how old were you, and had you ever met other blind people before?
No, I had never met anyone that I recall. I won't say never. Never is a hard to... I learned not to use never and always. But I don't recall anyone that I'd ever met at that point in time who was totally blind. Sure, I'd met some people who had visual problems before that time, but that was my introduction. And I was 5 years of age when I went to the Tennessee School for Blind. And in fact, one of the first people I met was Larry Fain. He and I started over there the same day. And in fact, my parents went over there, and Larry was a bit unhappy that his folks had already left, and my dad decided he'd sit down and console Larry, and it turns out it didn't work. It backfired. My dad, I think, was the one that ended up doing more of the crying. At least that's what he tells me now. But I know that was a shock. I went from a rural environment, as I described, with no modern conveniences and that sort of thing, and the School for the Blind was in Nashville and did have electricity and did have running water and bathtubs inside, and it is an eye-opener, I'll tell you. Sort of a cultural shock, to say the least.
I was just going to say to you, it must have been a cultural shock when you got there. I bet you remember it very, very well indeed. I think anybody probably does who's attended residential school for the blind. It is a bit of an eye-opener, forgive the pun, but it can come as a shock. Did you enjoy your days at school?
Well, yes and no. I was very attached to my family, and the first 4 months I was there, I think I was the biggest crybaby ever was. School buses, I knew, were the way to get there. And Greyhound buses were the buses that traveled cross-country back in those days to get from one city to the next. But there also were buses passing by that were local city buses that just served the Nashville area. I didn't know the difference. I was a little fella. And any time I saw a bus go by that had a shape similar to the buses I knew would take me home, I would tune up and go to crying, wishing I was on that bus heading home. And they had a very difficult time with me for the first 4 months there until the Christmas break, because we didn't get to go home. We were there from September until Christmas. And all new people I didn't know. There was a very wonderful lady who was our dorm supervisor. Thank goodness for her. She was just an absolutely wonderful lady. And she was mothering about 30 of us, or 40 of us, I suppose, and did the best she could. It wasn't the family, of course, but she made it tolerable for me because she did care. And there were people who unfortunately had jobs in at the school that did not care. But this lady most certainly did, and made life tolerable for us. But I enjoyed a lot of the things, of course, there at the school. And once I got to the point where I was not so homesick, I certainly did. I got involved in most of the different programs we had, and very frankly, we had more of those at the School for the Blind than the public schools offered. Not necessarily in the first, second, third grade, but later on, we got to see a lot of things, anything from the Marine Band coming to put on a concert to the Nashville Orchestra. The circus would come to town, and we'd go see the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus and the State Fair, and we'd see the tour boats going up and down the Cumberland River there with the Calliope playing and the people having an outing, and the planes would be writing messages in the sky, and just a lot of different activities that I was exposed to there that were not available to me at home. So ultimately, yes, I became very adapted to the situation, and while I still like to be at home and preferred home, it became a home away from home, and you had to learn to adapt to, as I say, there were some people there that should not have been there. Yeah, I guess just as in any other school, there's some folks that are there just because they have nothing better to do, I suppose. Those people need to be weeded out, but we learned how to adapt and how to work our way around those folks who were pains to deal with, and that's what you have to do even if you're in a public school setting, too. So, yes, I adapted, became to like it. I'm very supportive today of the idea that residential schools for the blind should be an alternative that's preserved for blind kids. The idea that we should do away with all of those schools, I think, is born out of ignorance of folks who don't realize the value of them.
Couldn't agree with you more. Similar experience myself. But your school sounded very enjoyable after you'd got your initial homesickness out of the way. What subjects did you particularly enjoy studying in those days, in your early days at school? Anything stick out in your mind that you really did enjoy doing?
Oh, sure. I always loved history, science, math. I say always. In the early going, it wasn't that great, but about the fifth grade, I had a transformation. I got to the point where I wouldn't do my work, and they told me that if I didn't, I would just fail. And I was stubborn enough to think, well, that's just tough. I'll do it my way. Well, they failed my little fanny, and said, well, you get to do this again next year, the same grade. And I was smart enough to figure out that was not part of the plan, and that I had just made a strategic mistake. Because I didn't like school that much at that point, and staying an extra year certainly wasn't going to help the situation. So I got busy the next year and started studying and applying myself, and I started making some A's and B's, some rather good grades, and enjoying the work and getting a little praise from a teacher now and then. That helped as well, and it got to be a habit for me, and I'll have to say that in retrospect, the teacher failing me was one of the best decisions that I had made for me, and it, while it was tough to have to go through that in some ways, it helped me. It changed my habits. I then got involved in sports as well, and I wrestled from the time I was 95 pounds all the way through high school, and managed to win the silver medal and come in second in the state my senior year, which I'm very proud of. I also was involved in the track, and while I was an embarrassment in the 1500 yard dashes, those that required real athleticism on the part of the person, I was an embarrassment, but on those long runs where conditioning mattered, I could I was willing to work hard at it. That's the only way I was ever able to have any success in athletic events, really, was just conditioning, because I wasn't what you'd call a natural athlete. But I was hard as rocks when it came to top conditioning. And that's the way I won my matches in wrestling. It wasn't the first minute that it mattered. It was the last minute that mattered. And the track, the half mile, the 2 mile was my events. So got involved with that also in music, played in the band, played the sousaphone, which is a great big old bass instrument that wraps around you, and learned to enjoy that, sang in the chorus, and even played piano, tried to learn piano, I should say, in the younger grades. Took that about 3 or 4 years and then quit, but I still learned enough to enjoy it. And I have a keyboard today that I play for my own entertainment. I will not play for other folks because I'm not talented like Mr. Fain. But still, I enjoy it. And that's a whole lot about what music is for the masses. It's just so we can enjoy either hearing other folks or mess around a little bit ourselves. But I got a well-rounded education, as I see it anyway. And I love physics, still. That's my favorite, I guess, of all courses in school, was physics. And, in fact, wanted to become a physicist. And, when I got to college, I was, persuaded rather strenuously by the physics professor at Tennessee Tech that that was not for me, that I could not do it and not to even start down that road. And that's the reason I ended up in the pre-law program. But does that cover your question, Steve?
More than adequately. Fantastic, Cliff. Thanks for that little insight into life at a residential school. You seem to, as you say, have a very, very rounded education and took part in lots of activities. But I'm surprised to hear you say that you wanted to be a physicist, because we didn't mention that the other day in our pre-interview, so that's very interesting. Did you not want to be a lawyer? I mean, you said physics was your first love, so after you were told that you couldn't do that, and you probably could have done, if you'd have pursued it, by the sound of you're a very determined guy. Who really decided then that you ought to take up law? Was it yourself or was it other advisors?
Well, that was my second choice. That was my choice. I'd always been interested in government, history, political science, and that sort of thing. And at one time I had the audacity to think I would love to become a United States Senator. And I think my second grade teacher had pointed out to me that I ought to become one, so I took her up on it. And didn't realize at that time what all was involved. I do now. I would love to be a United States Senator, but I don't want to have to go through what it takes to get there. Not that I could if I wanted to. But, yeah, that's physics was, as I say, that was my first choice. I always wanted to be that. The physics head of the department simply indicated that since I did not know what a slide rule was, couldn't use one, that there's no way that I could do physics. And I'm sure that I could not have done physics the way he wanted physics done. And since I did not go that route, I can't say for sure what would have happened to me. But I think I could have found a way to do the math. I may be fooling myself in that area, but I did later take 3 quarters of physics. Not the upper level courses, but the lower level courses. And I did manage to make straight 100s in all 3 quarters. We had the quarter as opposed to the semester system back in those days. So I had a year of physics, and I made straight 100s for the whole year. So I was encouraged by that, to think that had I pursued that career, that I probably could have made it. But by that point in time, I was already committed to the other pre-law program, and even though they didn't think anyone would hire a blind attorney. They said that they would at least let me in the course and I could take the classes. So that was better than the first offer over in the physics department.
And before I go and forget, Jennifer did mention that you made an engine. Did this happen at this period or did that come later, Clifford? And tell us about the engine.
Okay, I've actually not manufactured one. I hold a patent on the engine. It's a, I've got that patent about 14 years ago. It's a rotary, if you can imagine a cylinder of an engine that looks like an inner tube for an automobile tire. And that's, it's a cylinder that goes around and around like a donut shape, I guess is a good way to say it, and it has four pistons in that cylinder, excuse me, and two pairs that chase each other all in the same direction, and it's obviously unique or else they wouldn't have awarded me a patent for that. I've never gotten anyone to develop it. It's one of those things where it's a good idea but hasn't gone anywhere yet. I hope I can get something done with it before the patent runs out, but I'm not certain that that will happen. It also works as a pump or compressor, since it most engines, if you apply the power to the engine and make it turn, it will pump air. So that's what it basically works out as, is a pump compressor or an engine, depending on how it's configured. But it's still an active patent.
Fine. Well, wish you luck with it. I know absolutely nothing about mechanics or anything, so I can't ask you any intelligent or stupid questions about it. So, just well done, and I hope it works out for you one day and makes you a rich man. Can we take you back to the beginnings of becoming a lawyer? Could you explain to us the process of becoming a lawyer? I've no idea. I mean, I know you have to know a lot about the legal system, etc., but the very, very beginning, how on earth do you learn to become a lawyer?
Okay, well, you first have to obtain a degree in another subject. In other words, law school is what's called a graduate school, meaning you obtain your degree from the four-year college and then enter law school. And then you are required to take a three-year program where you study just law, just different aspects of the law. You'll have courses in procedure, what court do you go to and what kind of document do you file with the court if you want to bring an action against someone, or if it's a criminal case, where is that criminal case brought, what conduct is it that's illegal? In other words, if you swat your child's behind, is that illegal or is that required if the child is acting up? Different places have different laws. And as time goes on, 50 years ago, if your child acted up and you didn't swat its behind, you'd probably be held up and derided by the community. Today, if you swat the child's behind, you may have half the people that see that happen ready to turn you in to the authorities for abusing your child. So, anyway, you study the laws that apply, and that is a three-year, very intensive course of study. And in fact, I would say that the level of difficulty is much more in law school than college. The jump from high school to college for me was not great. There was some more difficulty involved, but I didn't find that to be a huge step. But going from the undergraduate school to law school was a marked difference, much more difficult, much more demanding. And the failure rate for law school at the time I went through was 60%. That may have had something to do with the fact that the Vietnam War was underway. We had about four military retireds on the staff, and a lot of people were in law school who had deferments from the military because of they were in law school. And those old military folks were determined that if you were going to come to law school to stay out of the military, that you're going to have to work and earn your grades. There wasn't anyone going to get a free ride, so the failure rate was fairly high at that particular time. And once the three-year course was completed, that's when the degree, the doctorate degree of laws is awarded. And then you still have to pass a state bar exam, which is a two-day exam that is an extensive examination covering all aspects of the law. And it is a, we call it in the country, a doozy. It many fail that as well first time around, or some of them never pass it. But I managed to pass that the first time around, and then started practicing law once I had passed the bar and obtained the state license to do so. Then it's really when you start learning to practice law. While you've learned a lot of academics and had some limited experience, practical experience in what we call the legal clinic, dealing with folks who came to the law school. They had a clinic set up there for folks who could not afford attorneys, and we offered limited services to them in order that we would obtain some practical experience. But the real experience began once you get out and start hands-on. And it's basically a learning by doing. That's the way it went for me. At least I did go in with another gentleman. And when we needed to do a deed or do a simple document, at least he had something I could use for a form to go by, and I wasn't just in the wilderness by myself. Of course, there are books that you can buy that have forms in them, but having another attorney to at least get started with made a huge difference, a good one for me. And from then on, it's just you have to research your facts of the case, and then you have to research the applicable law, and then you go into court if you want to. If it's the kind of case that needs to go into court, if it's the kind that doesn't, you tell your client they don't have a case. Or if it's a case where you're defending, someone's already filed a suit, then in that case you have no choice but to go to court. But you prepare your defense by assembling the facts, and then also again doing the research on the applicable substantive law, as well as the procedures that may need to be instituted to protect the client.
So during this learning phase, then basically it's reading law books and writing theses and writing essays and studying law. Did you do any role play? I know you said you advised people at law clinic when people could come in and ask advice, but do you ever get into a situation where you were doing role play, you know, taking the part of a prosecutor or a defense lawyer?
Yes, we had what we call moot court. And it was we were given a script to follow, and we would try cases before juries made up of other students and that sort of thing. And yes, we did that, as well as would also appear before a three-judge panel that was not a real three-judge panel. They were actual judges, but they were they would, again, give us scripts to go by, and then we were to write briefs and make our arguments and that sort of thing. And that was also a help. That gave you a somewhat of a feel of what the real world was like, although it was not the real thing. But it was a help, and enjoyed that as well, and did participate fully in all those aspects of the law school. Let me digress for one quick second, if you don't mind. I meant to mention it a while ago, and just to give you one experience that I it was sort of earth-shaking for a little fellow. The first fall when I was there at the school for the blind, lived out in the country the whole time, and attended a little church out in the country that had a piano that was half out of tune. And the folks out there who sang, very rudimentary, we made a joyful noise, I guess would be the right way to put it. But bluegrass wouldn't come close to what it was. It was more elementary than bluegrass sound. And anyway, that's all the music I'd ever heard. And I heard many preachers, though, and they'd talk about how the end of time was coming, and that there'd be angels singing, and we'd all be swept up into heaven, and all this sort of thing. And I was, had that drilled into my head from a little fella. Well, we go over to the school for the blind. I'm outside one night, and all of a sudden I hear these voices like I had never, ever heard in my entire life singing. And I heard this instrument playing that I'd never heard anything like before. I later learned that was a choir, and I never heard high voices singing soprano, for instance, and I never heard a pipe organ and none of that. I thought what I was hearing was angels, and I thought the end of time had struck, and I went running in to the dormitory, to the lady there, crying and upset because I knew that the end of time was upon us and that I would never be able to find all my folks up there in heaven and all those people up there just running around in all directions and scared to death. She finally got me calmed down and explained that after we went outside and listened to what it was that scared me, that was just ordinary choir practice. But afraid when I was a little fellow, I put two and two together sometimes and came up with the wrong answers.
Oh, that's fantastic. But what it does show is that even at a very early age, you had a very analytical mind, didn't you? You could tell you were destined to be someone who could argue a case, even at that age. That's a fantastic story. That's really, really funny. And I can just imagine it happening. Yeah, thought you'd died and gone to heaven. Oh well, maybe one day I'm sure you will, and then you can see if it's anything like the experience you had as a child. That's really good. So when you'd actually graduated from the law school, did you go and work for a firm, or did you set yourself up immediately with your own practice?
Well, I went in with another attorney. Actually, what happened was that in order to pass to become licensed and to pass the bar, you had to get a certificate from the president of the local bar association indicating that I was of good moral character. Rather silly requirement due to the fact that the local bar association had no idea who I was or that I even existed. But in any event, I had to come down and interview with the president of the bar at the time in our local county. And he and I struck up a conversation, and he had a little 8x8 office in the back that wasn't being used, and he offered me $150 a month guaranteed income if I wanted to come and occupy that little office. And that's an offer I took up, which I didn't have a better one at the time. And it was not a partnership or even an associate. I was just there taking up space and would do some work for him in order to repay him for the rent for that space. After, see, that was April 1st when I came. And by July, he had decided that he liked the type of work I was doing and offered me a partnership, and then we were partners then until I left there in 1982, so I was there for approximately 14 years as a partner with him. And then he decided to run for judge, and that was going to complicate life too much, so I went out on my own in 1982 and have practiced solo for the last 21 years. But that's having that other attorney's advice and forms to go by and that sort of thing, someone experienced enough at least to help you do the rudimentary things, you know, where's the door to the courthouse, you know, that the little simple things that you don't think of. It helps to have somebody blaze that trail for you when you're a greenhorn.
As a lawyer, do you have to make a decision to specialize in specific areas? Because it's a vast subject, I should think. Do you have to decide what type of work you're going to specialize in, or do you just do anything that comes along?
At the beginning, I did mostly everything that came along. I don't today, and there were some areas even back then I did not wish to practice. I've never done bankruptcy work, for instance, and I've never, never is the wrong word again. I've been in federal court once in all these years. And that was where someone else filed a suit against my client. I tried to stay out of those courts for very good reasons early on, because the judge was a tyrant and was very I didn't care for the man, did not want to be in his court, just put it like that. And so I stayed away, and consequently, when you stay away and you don't keep up with the rules of practice in the federal court, then you can't very well go back. So I've managed to stay out of those courts all these years. I have stopped doing some areas of practice. I no longer do criminal work, and I stopped doing that about 7 years ago. And I keep narrowing my focus, mainly because I can't do it all. Just no way to keep up with all the areas of practice that effectively, and I don't have the time. I just simply can't do it all anymore. So I might have been wise to have gotten another partner and tried to keep doing it all, but I prefer not to. I don't do Social Security claims anymore, for instance. That's disability claims. I used to do those. Stopped those about 10 years ago. And the older I get, the fewer types of cases I handle. But I've still got more than I can take care of, so I don't know. I'm sure there'll be another area of practice that I will stop doing here in the near future, just because of too many people tugging on your sleeve at the same time.
I think you told me the other day when we were speaking that you do divorce cases and advise people on what wills and things like that. Do you draw up wills for people and business partnerships? Is that the sort of day-to-day bread and butter work you do?
Yes, I still do all types of domestic relations cases, which involved divorces, adoptions, change of custody type cases where folks have decided they want to go back and have a second bite at the same apple over who's going to have the children and that sort of thing. I do quite a lot of wills and estate planning, handle estates where people pass away, and we have to take care of all of that for them. Do quite a lot of defense work in the area of personal injury claims. I represent insurance companies where we're defending people who have been sued. And believe it or not, I like that type of work quite a lot. Some people think that's the Grinch that stole Christmas, but I find that usually the folks who, the cases I end up trying, let's put it like that, are the ones where the folks who are doing the suing are the ones who are trying to jerk the system around and trying to abuse the system and try to get rich at the same time. And a lot of those claims are overly, making a mountain out of a molehill is probably a good way to describe it. Or they're just plain out and out fraudulent cases, which there's quite a lot of those around too, where people just try to make up injuries to fake injuries. They may have gotten actually injured 2 years ago or 20 years ago, but they want to come along now and try to pretend as though that little fender bender they had last year is the cause of all their woes. And then we go delving into the case and find out that a year and a half ago they were in a hospital for 2 weeks with the same type of complaints, with the same kind of injury. And I frankly enjoy ferreting out those kind of claims, and winning something like that is not only good for me, but I think it's good for our community. We all end up paying insurance to pay those kind of claims, and if we can stop the fraud, we save ourselves some money down the road. So I get a certain amount of satisfaction out of winning those kind of cases.
Now, when you were doing your criminal work, you must have come across some amusing situations or amusing cases. Obviously not amusing to the people involved, but you told me a wonderful story about a gentleman and an aeroplane when we spoke. I wonder if you'd like to tell us about that. It's a really funny and interesting story.
Well, you may have to remind me which one that was. I don't remember which story that would have been. What were some of the other details, Steve?
Okay, well, if I say the color green comes into it quite a bit.
Well, I'm afraid my mind has gone blank. I've slept two or three times since then. We've had some interesting cases over the years, needless to say. I guess I told you about the one where the lady, tried to say that my client was, his truck would go at the speed of an airplane, because she had gone to the trouble to calculate that my client had covered 3/8 of a mile, which she had measured, in the time it took her to cross the highway with her vehicle. And we got her to calculate that and figure out that the most that would have been 3 seconds. And then I asked her, well, if my client covered 3/8 of a mile in 3 seconds, in 8 seconds, how far would he have traveled? And she calculated, well, that would be 8/8 of a mile, or that would be actually a whole one mile in 8 seconds. And then I got her to calculate how many seconds there was in a minute, and that turned out to be 7.5, and that meant 7.5 miles in a minute. And that calculated out then to be 450 miles an hour. And I asked her then, did she really mean to tell this jury that my client, his S10 Chevrolet, would actually travel at 450 miles an hour on a crooked highway? And she said, well, that's the truth. That's the way it happened. So the jury had a good laugh, and I won the case. But I don't know if that's the story I told you, but that is a true story, and that's the way it happened. But math and science still comes in to help, even in this profession.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the story, Cliff. I'm sorry to put you on the spot. I feel bad now, but no, it was the... Let me see if I can jog your memory a little bit more, because it's really worth telling, about the man that took the aeroplane.
Oh, okay, yes, I do remember now. Well, I was appointed by the court to represent this fellow in a criminal case. He had stolen an airplane, and he was a local figure in our community, and he had stolen an airplane from the airport and flown it around a while and then landed it in the backyard and got out and left. And this fellow did not have a pilot's license, never had flown another airplane before. And I went down and interviewed him and asked him why he flew the plane. Well, he just wanted to. He always wanted to fly one, and he just couldn't resist. And not much of a defense, in fact. And so I go back up to court and I'm talking to some folks there about the case and trying to calculate what I was going to do. And somebody told me that I should I found out about the little green men that lived with this fellow. And I said, well, he didn't mention that. And they said, well, maybe you ought to go back. So I go back down and talk to this fellow, and I didn't want to mention green men. I didn't want to lead him into saying something that was wrong. So I just asked him about who lived upstairs. And then he started telling me about the little green men who lived not only upstairs, but in the basement and all around. And then his fertile imagination really began to show, and it became very obvious that this fellow had very serious mental problems. And fooled the heck out of me, though, when the first interview I had with him, not having been clued in to anything like that, he talked very rationally and very appropriately about the subjects we were discussing. But once I got into that, it got really wild. And turns out then the fellow did have a plea, a very good one, that he was not mentally responsible for what he had done, and he was not imprisoned. And he's turned out not to be a threat to society. He's not stolen any more airplanes. He's still around town. I don't know if they keep an eye out for him at the airport or not, but sort of a funny but sad case all at the same time.
Yeah, that's the one, Cliff. Yeah, I thought that was worth pursuing. Yeah, interesting case. Got its humorous side, of course, but as you say, at the same time, a little bit sad. But getting a little bit serious for a moment, I can't help but mention the fact that you told me you have been involved with one or two murder trials, and I know that in states in America, capital punishment is in force. Over here, of course, in England, we do not have capital punishment. We abolished it in the 1960s. Can you just tell us how it feels as a person who is confronted by someone you're trying to help or prosecute, for that matter, who could possibly die as a result of the outcome of what happens in court?
Well, I'll try to describe it. It's the most intense thing I've ever been involved with, by far. I had one, same group of defendants. I was involved in three separate trials with them, where the death penalty was being sought by the state, and had one other case we tried one time, and we well, actually, it ended up, I guess you'd say, we ended up with a plea in the case, but we did have a trial. But a plea was arranged right at the very end, right before the case went to the jury. So we don't know how that would have turned out. But it is very difficult for the defense lawyer. Difficult for everybody involved, frankly. It's hard to sleep at night when you're involved in a case like that because you're so concerned that any mistake on your part or lawyers are just human, and we can't remember everything that we would like to remember. You can always, when you get through the case, you can always go back and do the self-criticism and say, well, gosh, if I just asked that question or if I'd remember to do this, and do your very best, and you can always come up with some things that you could have improved upon. And when death is the penalty that's being sought, it's just tremendous pressure. I learned to try my best to get enough rest between the days of the trial, because those cases went on for a week, each case did. And in this area, a week's trial, those were the longest cases in history at the time in our county, because justice was a lot swifter in our county than it is in California, in places where you see trials go on for months. That's unheard of here, and still is unheard of here. But you had to get rest, but at the same time, you had to keep yourself totally concentrated on what was going on. You pretty well had to isolate family matters, anything else just that could not get in the way. You had to be totally committed to what you were doing. At least that's the way I felt. Because when I'm responsible for somebody's defense like that, they're depending on me, and I take it very seriously. There are some attorneys who go out and party and do their normal thing right on as though it doesn't matter. I can't do that. I'm not geared that way. It's something I'm glad I'm not doing anymore, frankly. It took its toll on me. I am not in favor of the death penalty any longer. I was until I became an attorney and saw how the system works. And to me, it's just so far from being perfect, that perfect. I don't think we need to be putting innocent people to death, and I think we certainly will in this country, and have in this country. And I would rather be able to go at least cut the bars apart with a welding torch and let them out if we find out 10 years down the road that they're innocent. You can't very well dig up a body and breathe life back into them once you've discovered that there's been a mistake. Some folks are willing to take those chances and say it doesn't matter. Our system is so, or our country is in so much need of law enforcement that we'll take that risk and just figure that that's just part of what you have to do to survive. I'm not willing to do that. There are a lot of defendants that deserve to be killed or worse. Some of the crimes they commit, as far as I'm concerned, they deserve to be tortured. But I don't think we as a society don't deserve to do it to them, and that's what we're doing in many instances. So that's how I've developed in my attitude toward the death penalty. I don't want to coddle these people. Gosh, they don't deserve that. But it's more what our society deserves that I'm concerned about than I am I don't feel for the guilty defendants. They deserve the punishment they get, and in some ways I think the death penalty probably is an easy way out for those folks.
Well, thank you very much, Cliff, for being so frank about such a serious and controversial subject. I must say, from a personal point of view, I do agree with you. There's a case over here just the other day where a lady was convicted a few years ago of murdering two of her own children, and now it's all come out that it was an illness, and she would have been put to death. There's no doubt about it, 50 years ago over here. Anyway, let's lighten up a little bit after that serious, very serious few minutes, and I wonder if you can see a correlation between being an actor and being a lawyer. Are you putting on a performance when you're in court? And do you think that good lawyers, it's their personalities which win the day? Do you think a lawyer's personality can sway a case?
I wish I could tell you no, but I'd be wrong. I think they certainly can. I think an attorney who's well spoken, who can be dramatic in presentation, can make a big difference. Jurors are human, you know, and gladly so have all the frailties of human beings. And that includes emotions, and those can be whipped up by someone who is skilled with the use of the human voice, as well as the body language, the entire presentation. So sure, makes a difference. I do think that our jurors are much more sophisticated today than they were 50 years ago. We do a much better job today of getting a good cross-section from the community to be on those juries. 50 years ago, you very often had what we call the spit and whittle club. And that is, you would they might bring in one panel of jurors, and they would throw those out for whatever reason. And then they would send the sheriff out to find whoever could be found in the town to serve on the jury. And that usually was the folks sitting around the courthouse chewing their tobacco, spitting, and whittling on their piece of cedar wood. So we had those folks, and they were very glad to serve on juries lots of times, because they made more money doing that than they did doing their spitting and whittling. And consequently, you had the same folks showing up on juries time and time again. And they were usually unemployed and or retired, and not necessarily the most desirable folks you'd want to have on a jury. So those folks were much more susceptible to an emotional show. I know of lawyers who they would use onions in their handkerchiefs to get their eyes to cry and that kind of thing. And it seemed to work with the juries of old. Nowadays, I think those folks would have that backfire on them. So we do have more sophisticated jurors, but anyone, no matter how sophisticated or how smart, can be influenced by a well-spoken presenter, as opposed to someone who is not very capable, or what's the right word? A buffoon. Buffoons don't cut it these days.
Okay, it's an interesting answer. I just wondered, you know, because on TV and radio drama, if you hear a tense trial, you know, the lawyers and the defense and the prosecution, and they seem to put on a performance. I just wondered if it was like that in real life. Working as a blind lawyer, have you ever had any strange reactions from either police officers or court officials or prosecution or defence or whatever, to the fact that you are blind, or do they accept you as just a lawyer?
Well, there's been a few times when I would say that I've had people who were sort of turned off to the whole idea that I was a blind lawyer, but I think most of the time I get respect. you mentioned in that group law enforcement. One of the funniest things that ever happened to me with a law officer was when I was in college. I was leading another blind fellow, and he was not familiar with the territory as I was, and I still had a little bit of vision at that time. But it happened to be a day when it was raining very heavily, and the sidewalk was literally a little stream of water, and it was a narrow sidewalk. And I'm sure we were looking very unstable, me trying to keep him out of the deepest water, and we were sort of lurching along the sidewalk. And so this policeman comes up and wants to check us out, see if we were drunk. And I told him no, I wasn't drunk, but I couldn't see. And he wasn't buying that story until the fellow that I was with, named Chester, reached up and pulled out his glass eye and showed it to the guy. But believe you me, he decided he didn't want to take us in very quickly.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, boy, I could just imagine. Yeah, that'd do it, wouldn't it? That'd do it, definitely. Well, Cliff, out of all the cases that you've been involved with over the years, which would you say has given you the most satisfaction of winning? Is there one that stands out in your mind where you think, wow, that was a good job done?
Oh, gosh. Been several. Not just one. I guess the there's one that comes to mind that I'll try to summarize it briefly. I was representing a lady who was operating an ice cream truck, and she was flagged down on the side of the highway by a group of children and stopped and was out giving them ice cream, selling them ice cream. And when a car topped the hill, some 700 feet south of that point, and it then proceeded to lose control and rolled over seven times, throwing out the occupants in the front seat, and one of which was killed and the other one seriously injured. And they claimed it was all because my lady had the road blocked with her ice cream truck. My client, the ice cream truck driver, by the time the case got to me, was suffering from cancer and told me that there was a little girl in the back of that car that when she came out made the statement that the car was doing 100 miles an hour when it topped the hill and that they were drag racing with the other car. Unfortunately, I couldn't find that witness by that time. At least I hadn't found her. I knew her name, but she had left and gone to the state of Florida. And my client then died from the cancer. And I was going to trial with that in that case with very few witnesses. I did have some of the kids who had stopped the truck, and they were, thank goodness, willing to testify to the truth about the matter, but still couldn't find at that point the witness, the little girl. And all I had was what my client had told me about what she had said. I found this girl 2 weeks before the trial, flew her in here, and got her on the witness stand just in the nick of time. And when she told her story, the whole everyone got angry at me, including the judge, because I hadn't told him about this witness and what this witness had to say. Well, needless to say, it wasn't up to me to tell the judge about what my case was about in advance. He had no reason to be clued in. And anyway, the whole group got right upset at me, but the jury didn't get right upset. The jury came back with a verdict in my favor. And it's one of those squeakers where you find your witness just in time and are able to get them in the court and get the story told. And It was looking rather bleak there for a while, but I've learned to listen to what my clients tell me. When they tell me the truth about something, you usually can bank on it, and if you can persist and find the supportive testimony, most of them will tell you the truth. And that's what I did in that case, and it paid off.
I can understand why why you're most proud of that. That's a wonderful story, and I'm glad it all turned out in the end. Again, it sounds like a true life TV program, doesn't it? You could imagine a program being built around that. That's very, very good, Cliff. Okay, as we come towards the end of the interview, can we just find out a little bit about you away from law? I believe you're married, and would just like to tell us a little bit about where you're living now and the type of things you like to do when you're not working as a lawyer.
Okay, fine, Dennis. So I live still in the same rural area. I live in a mountain valley. We have mountains all around us. To the west, they go up to about 2,700 feet in elevation. To the east, about 5,400. And I'm only about 1,000 feet above sea level here in this valley. So you can gather from that to the difference in elevations. I have my first wife, as I introduce her. We've been married 32 years. And have one son who's 23. He, in turn, now has my first grandson, who's 9 months of age and who's upstairs right now with my wife, and who's an absolute joy, happiest little guy that I've ever had the pleasure of being around. I'm rather inactive at the time, but I am a ham operator. I do enjoy that hobby. I do like fishing and I do like to get out and hike in the valley here and the mountains around here. I enjoy this hobby, getting on computers and carrying on with email with friends and classmates from years ago. What else can I say? In a short I like to go dancing. I should say that. Miss Donna, who came in earlier there, if I don't say that, she's going to banish me from the dance halls, we call them down here in East Tennessee. But I get to go down and listen to Larry Thane, who appears on here, and his band play and dance with all the ladies who are associated with the band members. So I must say I enjoy that. I'm not one of these dancers that get up there and do the fast stuff, but I like the old two-step and the waltz and the ballroom type dancing. So other than that, eating good food and having good company, that's about it.
Sounds a very busy life. Now, you forgot to mention this business with a saw. tell us about that experience you had with a saw, because you told me the other day, and it sounded absolutely horrendous. Tell us about that, Cliff.
Oh, well, I do use a power saw, which is used for cutting down trees. And I was cutting a tree one day that was I was cutting for firewood. It's about a foot and a half through in diameter oak tree, but it had a fence in it, so I needed to cut the tree off up higher than usual so that I would not get my saw into that old fence. If you do that, you ruin the chain on the saw. And so I cut the thing off, and all of a sudden, it jumped off the stump. And I thought, well, gosh, what's going on here? I finally found the tree. It was standing, still standing straight up right by the stump, but cut loose from the stump entirely. And I thought, well, okay, we'll see which way it's going to fall. But it just stood there. And the problem I had then was that if I decided to take off in any direction, the tree just might fall in that direction. And if it did, old Clifford would be history. So I had to stand around there about 10 minutes trying to figure out how I was going to solve that dilemma. And finally the wind came along and blew strong enough that it blew the tree in one direction. And while I'm standing close to the tree, of course, I was safe because I could tell when it started to lean to go in the other direction. And when the wind blew, I got out of my dilemma. But let me tell you, that's not a good place to be when you got something standing up like that and knowing that you can't run fast enough to get away from it. Had it started to fall, you just, like I say, they'd read about you in the newspaper. So I have resigned from cutting down large trees with my power saw now. I usually only will cut down small ones, and I use it, of course, to cut up wood that's where trees have already fallen. And I do use a power saw. Some people think blind folks shouldn't use them, but I've never cut myself, and I have sighted friends who've got the scars to prove that they cut themselves.
Oh, Cliff, if you'd have been injured, you could have sued yourself for being negligent. Now that would have been a really interesting case for you to fight. That would have been a real goodie. And just before we finish, I understand that you've also done a little bit of prospecting for gold. Now, tell me about that. That sounds most interesting.
Yeah, I have a friend who has a gold-bearing piece of property, and he had a dredge. Well, another friend actually had the dredge, but we pooled all of our resources together, and I like to be the man down in the water, I guess you'd say, because I can get down and feel the bottom of the stream and guide the nozzle that picks up the sand and the rock. I can do that as good as anyone can because a sighted person can't really get down in there and look at it and see what's going on either. Unless they have a complete diving outfit, and that we didn't have. So I thoroughly enjoy it. And when it's July and it's just 95 degrees temperature, getting down in a cold mountain stream like that and operating a dredge is not a bad way to spend the day. And we did manage to find some gold. We're still hopeful that we may find much bigger pieces in the future, and still have plans to go back and do more. But that's not exactly a wintertime activity.
I should think not, too. That's remarkable. Well, you've obviously led a very interesting life, Cliff. On behalf of everyone in the room, can I thank you for agreeing to be interviewed? I don't know if you've got the time, but I'm sure one or two people may like to ask you a question when we've officially finished. But again, thanks very much. And people out there, if you want a good lawyer, I think you'll find an admirable one in East Tennessee. Thanks very much, Cliff.
Well, I appreciate again the invitation to be back. This is my second time, and the first time I don't think we had any recordings going. It's probably just as well. But you've been a very good interviewer, Steve. I appreciate it. And I'm sorry I don't, I'm not as swift as I should be about remembering which story it is I'm telling about. But thanks again for the opportunity, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, Cliff, thanks very much. So there we go. Any questions for Cliff?
Whereabouts did you say you lived in Tennessee? I didn't catch that part of the interview.
Okay, I live near a little town called Tellico Plains, Tennessee. I live 7 miles southwest of that little town. We're about 30 miles south of Smoky Mountain National Park, and I'm only about 10 miles from the North Carolina line by the Crow method. And if you're not familiar with East Tennessee, smaller towns, we're about midway between Knoxville and Chattanooga, Tennessee, which are both larger cities in East Tennessee.
Cliff, I have a question. When you are in the courtroom, how do you take your notes? Do you use Braille or use a tape recorder? Or I know you have your secretary there. Can you tell me how you keep your notes for things you'd like to pursue?
Sure. I make my notes in advance as far as what I want, reminders of areas that I want to ask questions about. And I use the old Braille slate and stylus, which is entirely out of date. I do now have a Braille printer. In fact, I bought it from Bob, who often appears on this net. And finally, I actually got the thing hooked up about a month ago, and the secretary started doing a little test runs with it. So I may end up with a Braille printer that will actually help out in that department. But as it stands right now, I still use the Braille slate stylus to make my notes. As far as notes of what's happening in court, my secretary does those for me. Be just about impossible to make notes and question all at the same time. It is for me anyway, because I'm a lot more rapid fire than that. I don't let a witness sit there on the witness stand and go slow enough that I can be making notes. I try to prepare ahead of time, and I like the rapid fire method of cross examination. I think it tends to bring out the truth a lot more in witnesses. If you give them time to think, they'll very often do a better job of hiding the truth. But when they're called upon to do it in rapid fire fashion, very often the truth comes out.
Question: what has been your biggest case, and how many days was it?
Well, I guess the most significant case would be the capital murder cases. That I had three different trials, each lasted a week. That certainly would be the most significant cases, because that you know, that doesn't start to compare with dollars and dollars and cents. And as far as civil cases are concerned, I guess a will contest I had once that involved about $500,000 estate lasted the longest. I think it took us about 5 days to 4 days to try that. And I've been involved in cases where people are suing for millions of dollars, but I don't consider, just because some lawyer has added a bunch of zeros to a lawsuit, that makes it a more serious case. You know, I can sue for $10 or $10 million just as easily, and all you do is just add the zeros. So I look at the case in terms of what it really is worth, and more along the line of how serious the injuries really are, and what the actual damages really are, and not just the amount sued for. I hope that answers your question. But I mean, multi-million-dollar lawsuits are not uncommon, and I've been in several of those, and those can last anywhere from a day to 2 or 3 days, but in East Tennessee, at least, we don't try cases that go on and on and on forever. We get those cases heard and get them heard fairly quickly.
My question on the murder cases: did you win, Aaron? If you didn't win, did you feel that the person was guilty too?
No, I did not feel the person was guilty, and I did ultimately win. What we had was three different trials, all of which ended in hung juries. And we finally made a motion with the court saying, Judge, we could try this case 50 times and we're going to end up with hung juries each time because it's, by the nature of the case, some people are going to believe one side and some are going to believe the other each and every time we try the lawsuit, and we're never going to do, we're never going to reach an unanimous verdict. And for that reason, please bring this to an end. And the judge agreed, and so did the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, and the case was brought to a halt because the courts just finally determined that we would never, ever get a unanimous verdict.
Cliff, have you ever defended someone that you actually deep down thought was guilty?
Oh, sure. I defended several folks I knew was guilty. Of course, we always, there's two things to that. One is guilty of what, and the next thing is guilty of what's the punishment going to be. And as far as a lot of people don't understand what not guilty means. When I walk into a courtroom and said, Your Honor, my client pleads not guilty, that literally means, Your Honor, I'm calling upon the state of Tennessee to prove their case. It is not an assertion that my client is in fact not guilty of the crime. That's not what that means. And I had in all the years I did criminal work, I had one case where a guilty party walked out of the courtroom a free man without any punishment or anything. And all I did in that case was to announce to the court that we were ready for trial, at which point the court or the attorney general advised the court that he had no evidence to proceed and therefore was dismissing the case. A lawyer has a legal and ethical duty not to put a witness on the stand who's going to testify falsely. And when you see O.J. Simpson not taking the witness stand, that meant that his lawyers knew, in my opinion, that he was guilty and that they had an ethical duty not to let him get on the witness stand and deny something that they knew to be the truth. Now, I don't know that for a fact, but that's an educated guess. Anytime you see a witness, a defendant not take the witness stand, it is a pretty strong indication that that person is guilty and the lawyer knows it and will not let them take the stand. A lawyer cannot, even in a civil case, do that. And a lot of people don't realize that. Now, that's not the same as to say that when they call on me to enter a plea for my client, not guilty, does, again, is not an assertion that my client did not do the acts complained of. It's just a simple way of making the state prove their case. And we've got to keep that happening, because if it ever gets to the point where anyone who is accused is assumed to be guilty, we are in real trouble then, because we all know that during our lifetime that someone will get angry at us, and if all they've had to do is go make a false charge against us to get us convicted, or that we had to prove our innocence based on some allegation like that, that would not be a good system. But that's the nature of a not guilty plea, and I don't think a lot of people really understand what that really means.
What would be your most notorious, or should I say publicized, case that you've ever had?
The murder case that we had to try three times. It was portrayed in the press as a feud between families, and it had been going on for quite some time, this dispute had been. And been lots of incidences before that. Cabins were burned, and shootings had occurred before that. And so it would it was a conflict that had lots of press prior to the death of the fellow that brought about the murder case. So it was already high profile. The conflict between these folks was already there before the murder case came about. So that was by far the most reported case that I've ever involved with.
Do you feel that the press interferes an awful lot with the court decision?
I think that the courts let that happen sometimes. I think that the judge in the O.J. Simpson case, for instance, I think having TV in the courtroom certainly made a difference there. And I think he let that get completely out of control. And he was playing to the audience more than he was to the taking care of business as a presiding judge. I think he wanted to, he was more concerned about his how he would appear to the general public, about whether he was being reasonable or all this sort of thing. And I think it just it caused, I think, a great miscarriage of justice. I cannot imagine a defense working in East Tennessee like that one did out there, which I felt like it was a defense that says, so what, I may have done it, but after all, I'm one of you. And that is a horrible, if you stop and think about it, that's a horrible approach. One that I just, I better quit while I'm ahead about that, but I thought it was a terrible miscarriage of justice.
One other question, then I'm going to quit. What do you think of cases that goes from judge to judge, like two or three judges?
Well, I assume you're talking about a case that's appealed from the trial judge up to the Court of Appeals. And then on to the Supreme Court. Is that your question?
Not really. Well, I'll tell you what it is. When I got my divorce, I ended up getting three different judges over my divorce, and I thought it was uncalled for.
Well, don't quite understand why that's the case. That would not happen in the courts I practice in. You would have the same judge from beginning to end. And don't quite understand why that is, but of course there's no reason why you if you're talking about different steps or different if you're granting the divorce one time and if you're going back 2 years later over a custody battle over something that's occurred since the divorce, then it should not matter that it's a different judge. But if you're talking about just getting a divorce, I can't imagine why in the world they'd have three different judges having three different hearings. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but I'm not familiar with where you're from or anything like that, so I really can't comment on it.
Well, the whole thing was really screwy. The lawyer that I have now is no longer a lawyer. He got disbarred by a policeman who worked in this town. And I just think it's very unusual to have three judges over one divorce.
Well, I'm sorry you had a lawyer who got disbarred. That doesn't sound like he was somebody that would have been beneficial to you. I can't answer that question. I really don't know. Why it occurred that way, and I agree with you that it should not. Doesn't make good sense to me, but I don't know the circumstances either, so I can't really comment much more than that.
I have just one question. It's more like an opinion from you. There have been any number of cases in the past 5-10 years where men and women have been released from prison after spending 5, 10, 15, even much as 20 years. No one seems to be accountable for why a person was sent to prison. And by that I mean, sometimes I think the district attorney knows more than he tells the court, or law enforcement may mislead district attorneys, but nobody's held accountable. Nobody comes by and says, hey, look, we made a mistake, we're sorry. Can you give me an opinion on that, please?
Didn't quite understand your question now. You're saying that you think that the district attorney general is being too harsh and obtaining convictions that carry 5, 10, and 15-year sentences? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't clear. People have been sent to prison who were found to be innocent of the crime 10, 15, 20 years later, and they're released because the lawyer has went to battle for them and said, look, this man is innocent. And I'm always thinking, how do they prove, well, not prove, but how do they convince the court and jury that a man is guilty? And I always had the feeling that the DA held back evidence or something didn't go right in that case, and that person had to spend so much time in prison, and no one's held accountable for it after he's released and found innocent.
Well, don't say always. There are some cases pending now where people were wrongly convicted, and they're suing the state. If the state, in fact, withheld evidence which would have tended to exculpate or render innocent or prove the innocence of the defendant, then I think there will be cases where the state will have to pay for some of those cases, and should, in my opinion. If an innocent person goes to prison because a state attorney general, the prosecutor, acted inappropriately and hid information from the court that would have set the man free, by all means, that the state has wronged that person. Sometimes it's not that way. Sometimes it's a matter of there is just not the evidence available to either side to prove the innocence or guilt of that person, or the innocence in your examples. And that evidence may show up later in the form of a witness who comes forward, or now there's some DNA tests that are available that were not available at all. Science is always improving, and there's some scientific tests that are becoming available to prove or disprove an issue that was important when the conviction occurred. And some people are benefiting from that, and I think that's the innocent people who are able to prove that certainly should be allowed out. I really get bothered by these prosecutors who want to keep people locked up even when the evidence is presented and they realize now that, okay, a mistake was made. Some of these guys still want to maintain that, well, it doesn't matter, that's our system, that's just the way it is. Tough luck. Those guys ought to be run out of office, in my opinion. That approach has no place in modern law enforcement, as I see it. There is a recent case, I think, in Arizona or New Mexico that has changed the burden of proof somewhat to the point that prosecutors are now concerned that there will never be finality to cases, and I do have some problem with that. But where in fact there's been misdeeds or where miscarriage of justice has taken place, people ought to be allowed to come back into court and to prove it. We don't need to be locking up innocent people. We certainly don't need to be putting innocent people to death.
Thank you for your response. I like to be able to take your complete response and put it in some newspapers and kind of, you know, wake people up to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we got to do something, because DA, they just continue in business and as usual. You know, you say they don't care, and they just, you know, there's no threat hanging over their head that they could be fired or demoted or whatever. And they just seem to be able to do whatever it is they want to do. Down here in Miami, we've got 11 police officers now that have to go and clear themselves of wrongdoing that occurred, 10, 12 years ago. It just doesn't seem right. But I thanks for your response. I learned something tonight.
Clear for David, the federal laws for that. you know, where people have been proven wrong. I'm talking about federal, because, you know, they're a state. There have been several cases throughout the states to where, you know, that continues. Are there any federal laws in place to protect anything like that so it doesn't become a beast?
Well, Bob, I'm not aware of any federal statute that addresses that. Of course, you have the Constitution, which allows for due process of law for all of us. And I think certainly there's arguments that could be made that if you have now discovered evidence that proves that you were innocent from day one and proves it, basically without any argument, I think due process requires that you have another an opportunity to prove your innocence myself. I don't think we just say, well, if the case is over, it's final, it doesn't matter what we've discovered now. Mistakes are made, and I think the idea that we want to pretend like they're never made is silly. I also think that we do have to be careful. We don't want to have to retry every lawsuit that's been tried, because witnesses die, evidence disappears. A lot of cases you could not go back and convict. I would dare say half the prison population if you had to retry those cases, because evidence is probably not available now. So we do have to be careful, not just have a wholesale let's try them all over again approach. That won't work. It's got to be only in those narrow cases where there's been some definitive evidence developed to show that this person, in fact, is innocent.
Sorry to interrupt, guys, but I just have a message from Dennis to say that he's got to stop recording shortly. Obviously, you can carry on chatting, but once again, Cliff, thanks very much.
Okay, well, thanks much, and we'll stop at this point. We don't want to tax Dennis up there. His equipment probably won't to go but a certain length of time. And appreciate it. I'll hang around if somebody wants to ask a quick question or two, and then I'm going to have to go pet a grandson.
Thanks a whole lot, Cliff. It's been a great interview. Really appreciate it.